Chapter 5, Musica Neurotica, Eastman, Heart of Darkness. My parents drove me to Rochester to start my career in music school. I moved into a formidable stone dormitory that was a 15-minute walk from campus. Soon enough, I would have to make that walk in the dark during blizzards. My roommate was a tubist from Georgia who had never seen snow. He didn't have long to wait. After the first storm, he ran outside in bare feet and threw snowballs for a couple of hours with no gloves. I had tripped a lot the previous summer and figured I'd not do any psychedelics during the school year and smoke only rarely. There was plenty to do, and I wanted to focus on my work. During the auditions, it was clear that my violin skills were not competitive with the performance majors. After all, they had been practicing 3 or 4 hours a day for most of their lives, while I had been getting a very general education. My violin teacher was Norma Owsen Leonard, and I couldn't have asked for better. I started composition lessons with Joseph Schwantner. I respected his work, but his music was very different from what I wanted to write. As a result, we didn't get much into details of composition. Most of what we talked about was calligraphy, of which he knew a great deal. In those long-ago days, the technology of making scores had not advanced for about 50 years. Engraving cost about $70 a page, so we were limited to manuscripts and Ozolid reproduction, which used light shining through the page to be copied. That meant using very expensive translucent paper and black ink, making any alterations very difficult. Parts were extracted by hand using the same process. Joe made his own 5-point pen for drawing staff lines, almost identical to those used by 18th-century composers. Like all my peers, I found this approach to copywork tedious and a terrible waste of time. After fussing with the Ozolid method, I thought, fold this five ways and put it where the moon don't shine, and resorted to simple xerography. After all, I was here in Xerox's hometown, where the moon didn't shine, but the Genesee River did, with residue from both Xerox and Kodak factories. A fellow succeeded in developing film in Genesee River water. From then on, I used photocopy machines and legal-sized paper for my scores and parts. Joe and I also talked a lot about student rebellions from his days in college not long before, and he lent me a book about political radicals. That was about all I got out of composition lessons. Béla Bartók was offered a post as a composition teacher when Eastman was founded, but he refused, saying composition could not be taught. That's been my experience as well. I studied scores and listened to piles of records in the remarkable Sibley Music Library as many hours as I could spare. That, along with performance, was my education in composition. I had never lived in an urban environment before. Eastman was in a part of town that had been not so bad in the 1920s, but now it was the Wino District. Next to the school was a bowling alley, whose upper floor served as the local mafia headquarters. One day, I was wandering about on the roof of the music building, en route to entering my upper floor English class through the window. Old habits are hard to break. I looked out over the city and was disheartened at how ugly and dirty the landscape appeared. Mercifully, it was soon covered with snow and concealed in darkness. Orchestra rehearsals were a dismal grind. Our conductor got the usual derision and contempt musicians customarily have for twits with sticks, and in this case, it was most certainly deserved. Someone once asked him why we never played Bach, and he responded, "Because his music is too easy." So we played Liszt. One day, the winds were messing up, and he stopped and said, "Play better." Golly, that was helpful. During a performance of Beethoven's 3rd piano concerto, during one of the standard cadenzas, he brought the orchestra in early 3 times, then just waited sheepishly until the pianist indicated he was through with his solo. The next year, he went to Yale. We wore white tie and tails for concerts. Actually, I wore tails most of the time, having brought mine from Andover. But I was too cheap to buy the white tie. Instead, I cut a bow tie shape out of a stack of napkins and used a safety pin to attach it to my collar. Unfortunately, flop sweat combined with the violin against my neck to result in droopage of the paper, which I ignored. I was back into second violins anyway, and didn't figure anyone was watching. The tails added dramatic effect while skating in the main lobby. The lobby floor was polished marble, and I had sneakers with especially slick soles. This allowed me to use the same technique as speed skaters, bending over and swinging my arms, to skate the length of the lobby at considerable velocity. Eastman has a phenomenal chamber music auditorium, Kilburn Hall. I was listening to a piano recital there featuring a piece by Mozart. During a break, a graduate student in the row ahead of me said to his friend something about how bland the performance was, and I chimed in, "Yes, when you play Mozart, you must draw blood." They turned around and gave me a look that said, "You're not one of us, are you?" And, of course, they were right. As the sun fled to more southerly realms, and the sky went gray and black, and the slush and ice season took hold, I felt more and more out of place. Naturally, one solution was to make others miserable as well. About a third of the student body had perfect pitch. I was a strong whistler at the time, and found 2 conspirators who were as well. During supper in our crowded dining hall, one of us picked a central note, while another whistled a quarter tone above, and the third a quarter tone below. We held it that way until shouts of despair came our way. I was hoping for projectile vomiting, but we were not loud enough. Social rank was determined mostly by performance ability, which was not to my advantage. Perhaps the most amazing student musician at that time was trumpeter Al Vizzuti. His senior recital consisted of a wide range of virtuoso literature from Baroque to jazz, performed from memory, all of which he had first seen 3 weeks before. It was flawless. One day at supper, he was eating at the next table over, and I gave him a friendly greeting, as we had not yet met. He responded, "Are you walking around with a hole in your head, as usual?" The others at his table smirked. This was not a good symptom. The students in the room across the hall from me had a recording of Arthur Schnabel playing Beethoven's Hammerklavier Sonata, and another of the Budapest String Quartet playing the Grosse Fugue. Well, we played them on alternating nights for many weeks. This was not well calculated to preserve our sanity. Visiting home for the holidays required 10-hour bus rides. On a trip from Rochester to Boston, one passenger spoke loudly of having started off in San Francisco after enduring electroshock treatments. No, he wasn't a hippie. He'd been on the bus for 3 days and was clearly the worse for wear. In the seats in front of him were a retired couple from Finland who spoke no English. Our demented passenger was convinced they were speaking to each other in Catholic and that they were part of the global Catholic conspiracy. After things got progressively beyond strange, the bus driver decided enough was enough. At the next toll booth, he alerted the state police, pulled over the bus, and told our passenger he had to go, which he did when convinced at length that the police were Protestant. That was one of only two contacts with organized religion during my stay at Eastman. The other was a project I did for my art history class, where I wrote a paper about Matthias Grunewald's Eisenheim altarpiece. This has musical significance due to Hindemith's Matthias de Mahler. Some of my fellow students thought that this project meant I was a religious fanatic, which I found astonishing. My whole reason for being a musician was rooted in devotion and spirituality, although in a rather primitive stage at the time. I had to keep all that to myself in this extremely materialistic and competitive environment. Eastman was no ivory tower. If this is what classical music was like, then I was training for a life that was not what I wanted at all. Music was my form of prayer and communion. The concert hall was my church. Of what use is competitive prayer? And even with all the pressure and intensity, only about a third of my classmates ended up with careers in music. The odds for composers were far lower. One composition student I met did pretty well. Eric Iwasen was a year older than me and was a phenomenal pianist. He was already gaining some recognition for his extremely complex and virtuosic pieces that he somehow managed to play. I was unable to appreciate his music at that time, but certainly admired his technique. Eric went on to have a long career teaching composition at Juilliard and has done very well as a composer. The running gag was that if he had a daughter, he'd name her Kiwi-A. All about new music. I never did like music in the contemporary styles, and further exposure to cacophony did little to endear it to me. Students ran around with Babbitt squares, which were primitive matrices used with serial compositions to determine all the things that used to be decided for musical reasons, like pitch, rhythm, and dynamics. No actual ideas were necessary, and anyone could crank out a 12-tone masterpiece, just like the big boys. Of course, only you, perhaps your teacher, and your family would hear it or care about it, and you never could tell about them either. After all, the result was indistinguishable from random sounds, which inspired the rise of aleatoric music, the easiest of all to write. In this method, the composer leaves the fussy, difficult details to chance, or the performer, to make up on his own. And if getting actual musicians was too much of a pain because you couldn't find anyone to play naked underwater, the latest, greatest fad was conceptual music. This wasn't even intended to be performed, or even be possible to be performed. Thankfully, Joe Schwantner was very reasonable, but from others I saw what the avant-garde norm was in music schools at this time. There was a minor industry feeding off the largesse of institutions supporting insufferable gibberish that no one besides new music specialists could bear to hear. Harold Rosenberg nailed it when he said the avant-garde was, quote, a profession one of whose aspects is the pretense of overthrowing it, close quote. Everything had to challenge the limits of the audience and break down barriers, even when doing so was an old, tired, disreputable orthodoxy. But disliking this junk branded someone in the field as an untrained barbarian and ignorant of all the wonderful theoretical advances. The winners of this game picked who else could play, and they didn't want competitors who would be popular with audiences. After a few generations, the result was a profession so remote from filling the aesthetic needs of the audience or musicians that most of the general public didn't even know it existed. The battles were all the more bitter because the prizes were so small. Three big names from New Music came to give talks at Eastman while I was there: Pierre Boulez, Milton Babbitt, and George Crumb. As the dear reader can only be expected to tolerate a finite dose of vented spleen, I will only describe Babbitt's visit. A large crowd filled our biggest lecture hall to see the great man expound on his latest ideas. He wrote on a blackboard the stunning idea that we could assign a number from 1 to 12 for each of the 12 pitches, and then perform mathematical operations on these numbers to write music. Now, the audience could follow up to the word mathematical, but after that, their eyes glazed over, and they felt they were in the presence of genius. But in the years the others had spent 4 hours a day practicing, I had been studying math and science, and it wasn't magic to me. What Babbitt was doing was geared to be impressive to his audience, but had little artistic merit. His idea was that New Music scores should be like papers published in scientific journals, appreciated only by other professors, and best if incomprehensible to the non-initiated. But I knew what he was talking about, and it was crap! The only kind of rigor in music is rigor mortis. I was to see the same game again in years to come. Had my own music been exceptional, I could have had something constructive to offer. But in fact, my efforts were very immature and nothing to write home about. I performed a sonata for violin and piano at a student composition concert. It is now safely expunged from my catalog. I did much better hanging out in a practice room with Bevan Manson, one of my classmates, who was an excellent pianist and improviser. Just jamming with him was a much more satisfying result than what I'd written, but we only did it once or twice and never performed. Bevan has had a good career since then with both jazz and classical music. The jazz performances at Eastman were extraordinary, and if I had felt comfortable with the idiom, I would have tried to convert over from classical. But I just never felt like that was where my heart was. Apart from some Coltrane, jazz was rarely associated with spirituality, and I had no interest in the gritty urban basis for much of the jazz culture. Most certainly, I had no connection with the kinds of hard drugs that were traditional among many jazz musicians. The main subject matter in jazz songs was love and sex, in which I was clumsy, inexperienced, and unattractive. And, truth be told, most ordinary jazz sounded to me like strangling geese. At least the jazzers had a good reason to study theory, since they had to follow chord changes instead of written out parts. My fellow legit composers seemed misled by all the cerebral fussing about and disconnected from the creative flow, so I held most theory in low regard. Typically, after years of hard theoretical studies, the result was music even more boring and mechanical than before the years of study. I struggled with the theory classes and got a solid C the first semester. This was a matter of some concern, since I needed to have a 3.0 average to keep my scholarship. My first semester grade point average was 2.6 out of 4. With grade inflation rampant in most courses, that put me 118th out of a class of 122. For the first time, I really had to sweat about grades. I was at a disadvantage compared to other students who were used to public high schools, where making sure the teacher liked you was the main skill required to pass, especially in non-quantitative classes. I was too proud and too stubborn to be obsequious on demand. I went to one of only two rock concerts in my life during this year, with Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. I brought earplugs. I've always admired Zappa's writings and approach to life and music, but I have little ability to appreciate his music. Still, he's certainly a hero for me. One day on the elevator, I met a fellow who I thought was a janitor. Pudgy, balding, and with an old stogie in his mouth. Turns out, this was Oscar Zimmerman, one of the greatest bass players and teachers in the world. He would get together with cronies to screen a copy of Birth of a Nation and play secretly recorded discs of Toscanini rehearsals, complete with insane screeching and temper tantrums. Oscar had been a bassist in the NBC Symphony. He could solfege at tempo everything he played, and he could play very, very fast. By the beginning of the second semester, I was getting more and more depressed. February had a total of 11 hours of clear skies, and I saw the moon once through the clouds. One blind classmate habitually banged his head against the wall, and a few years later committed suicide. There was no provision for lunch, so I took heavily sugared donuts from breakfast and microwaved them to keep me going during the day. After a few months of this, my hands were shaking. I wasn't eating any red meat, but the rest of my diet was way out of balance. I was not a happy camper. Throughout my college career, I didn't trip during the school year, since I was extremely busy. However, in this grim winter and early spring, I was drawn to marijuana and smoked regularly. This left me tired, spaced, and even more prone to depression. One night, the fire alarm went off, and we all had to go outside in the snow. Someone had run down the hallways, burning the posters people had hung on their doors. The place was full of smoke. Nobody knew who did it. The next night, the same thing happened. This time he'd gone all the way to the basement, chased by a resident assistant while lighting door posters and igniting a couch. Things were getting serious. Finally, we found out it was a trombonist, and he was expelled. After months of cold weather and stress, my left hip started hurting again, and it was difficult to walk to school from the dorm. I went to the school doctor, and he said I had arthritis. I was advised to buy aspirin in bulk, and when that didn't work anymore, they'd put me on cortisone. I was so offended by the cavalier attitude and silly grin he and the nurses had, and the lack of any real help or specific diagnosis, that I didn't get a proper diagnosis from a doctor for 9 years. When the weather warmed up, my hip felt better and I forgot about the trouble. In April, it was time for our juries. I had improved a good deal over the year on violin and chose to play my violin sonata for the jury. My friends warned me not to, saying that the jury only wanted to hear music they knew. But I insisted that I wrote the piece to be heard, had worked on it for many months, and they would like it. My turn to play was at noon, when the jury started eating lunch. They broke out the food and were talking loudly to one another the entire time. My playing did not lessen the high volume of their conversations or the gusto of their dining. Welcome to the world of classical music. The first semester, I had an enjoyable English class. The second semester, I had a new English teacher whose teeth appeared to be smoothed by continual gnashing. The University of Rochester would sometimes send Eastman the lesser lights on the faculty for the side courses we had to take, and this was certainly one of those very dim bulbs. Our mutual loathing was not to my advantage, and the C he gave me brought my grade average to 2.8. This stopped my scholarship, and so just as the sun came back and the clouds parted for glorious spring weather, my Eastman adventure came to an abrupt end. What next? My parents also were forced to relocate when the Antiquities Society that owned the Fowler House decided to use the place for storage. They moved to an apartment in Peabody, the next town over from Danvers. Living in a much smaller space was decidedly negative for their relationship. Returning to stay with my parents for the summer, I had to find a cheap school that would let me in quickly, since most had application deadlines that had already passed. While thinking about this, I visited Anton up in Bowdoin. He was finishing up his first year living in a frat house. Another student in his house painted a large pentagram on his room's floor and had the whole decor set up for satanic rituals, which, apparently, was the style at the time. Anton thought it was amusing and interesting, while I was repulsed. Dad mentioned North Texas State University back in the dimly recalled Denton, which had a good music school. I applied, sent a tape of my playing unaccompanied Bach, and was quickly accepted with a little scholarship requiring short hours of labor. Entirely out of the blue, I was returning to my hometown and an entirely new way of life. I'd overheard someone at Eastman say that no one since Beethoven had done something like the Große Fuge. Naturally, I responded, "Oh yeah? Says who?" and started my own variations on the Große Fuge for string quartet and double bass while visiting Anton, who had moved into a yurt at Bowdoin. This would be my main compositional activity for 2 years. North Texas State University, fall 1974. Landing at Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, the air hit me like a wet mattress. I settled in to Kendall Hall and explored my new territory. This was late August, and the heat was Indian in magnitude. The trees were curiously stunted and shriveled. I walked over to my former home at 505 Welsh. The house was moved to the countryside some time previously, and the vacant lot was soon to be parking for the school. The color of the grass was a vibrant green, and it all looked alive, while my memories were comparatively drab. This was unmistakable residue from LSD, and I was glad to have it. NTSU ranked in the bottom quarter of universities, despite the excellent music school. This was definitely a Cal College experience, but I'd learned to appreciate simple things and was grateful to have the opportunity to be a student. Besides, the sun was shining. The winter was mild. I could leave during the torrid summers. The people were friendly. And I could be as weird as I wanted, and no one bothered me about it. This was actually a comfortable and relaxed environment. And in time, I didn't mind leaving Eastman. We signed up for classes in the Coliseum, the large area built for basketball. As I stood waiting in a long line, wide-eyed students went through the crowd saying, "Don't sign up for Dick Army! Don't sign up for Dick Army!" Who is this guy Army, I thought, that students would hate him this much with universal fervor? I was to learn a few years later. Thankfully, I didn't need to take economics, which was his subject. My scholarship job was in the musicology office, where I handled shoeboxes full of Hollerith cards with records of all the dissertations for musicology students in the country. There were thousands of these papers to keep track of, with titles like "On the Cowherd's Songs of the Basques in the Pyrenees." An astonishing amount of time and effort went into producing these long texts that no one would read or care about in the slightest. That was my introduction to life in graduate school. In all the confusion of landing at a new school, I missed the auditions for the orchestra. The conductor, Anshul Brusilov, put me in the back of the second violins and said, if I was good, it would be obvious and I'd move up. In 2 years, I was in the first desk of the seconds, which put me directly in front of Anshul and in the perfect spot for listening and observing the orchestra in action. It was also a great location to mess with Anshul's head. In those days, I had one far-sighted and one near-sighted eye. Looking back and forth from music to conductor grew wearisome, and one day, during a break in rehearsal, I went outside and broke out one of my lenses with a rock. On resuming the rehearsal, when I knew Anshul was watching, I nonchalantly put my finger through the now empty frame to scratch my eye. Definitely disrupted the proceedings. After difficulties with the conductor at Eastman, Anshul was a real inspiration. This was how it should be done. Leading an orchestra in a music school is more challenging than a professional orchestra, where people already know most of the music and could play pretty well without a conductor at all. He could communicate with extraordinary skill and artistic integrity and knew what was going on everywhere. I was deeply impressed and learned a great deal about every aspect of music for large ensembles by playing under his direction. Anshul started his career as a violinist, 4 years as assistant concertmaster in Cleveland, and 7 as concertmaster under Ormandy in Philadelphia. He conducted the Dallas Symphony for 3 years before starting at NTSU in 1973. With this experience, he knew all about professional music making at the highest levels and what skills we needed to join orchestras after graduation. Although I was too thick to appreciate it at the time, however much I admired his musicianship and benefited from the association, Anshul had a very different set of ideals that didn't have much in common with mine. He was comfortable with his formidable ego, while I saw my own as a barrier to spiritual development and good musicianship. He preferred to be surrounded by sycophantic graduate students, while I was too proud for that kind of thing. And worst of all, he admired the conventional and predictable and avoided eccentricity. While the dear reader will have observed that my lifestyle was extremely bizarre, as part of that conservatism, he was absolutely not going to feature new music unless he had to, as with the case of compositions by faculty members. I was determined to win him over with the music I had not yet written, and thus had every reason to believe was very good. While the classical program was solid, the school was famous for its jazz, with an unofficial motto of faster, higher, louder. There was a wide range of abilities given the large number of students, but the best were certainly professional quality and supplied big bands and other groups all over the country. After 3 years, I broke down and sat in on a rehearsal with Schwanz Lefants, a Denton band whose violinist was away that night. I actually improvised with a shirtless saxophonist and a drummer and everything. These guys stayed up too late for me, so it was a one-time experiment. Texas was swarming with Christians, which was a novel experience. I didn't know any churchgoers at Eastman, but half the students here went most Sundays. There was a church whose sign said, quote, "The Church by Jesus Christ," unquote, where, quote, "born-again Christians believe on the word of the Lord," close quote. On an orchestral bus trip to San Antonio, while talking to the violinist seated next to me, I mentioned dinosaurs for some reason. "Well, if you believe in them," he responded. "That's interesting," I thought. "Most third graders are experts on dinosaurs, and this college student doesn't know about them because of his church. My good friends in the dorm were really fine, kind, and caring people, but our belief systems were worlds apart. What was most dear and meaningful to them made little sense to me, and I'm sure vice versa. It was very interesting. They put up with my heathen Hindu ways very well. After several months, I noticed a dark shadow on my bed where I slept. It was a bit mysterious. Then I figured it out. Our sheets at Andover and Eastman were washed for us, and I had completely forgotten that laundering them was necessary. Also, various dust balls and scraps of music manuscript paper completely filled the space under the bed. My walls were covered with hundreds of identical pictures I had clipped from the student daily newspaper of a particularly homely doctor recently hired by the school. In fact, I had taped his picture all over the campus one night for no particular reason. I was settling in nicely. Actually, for a composer, this wasn't that bad. After Erik Satie died, his friends broke into his apartment and found four upright pianos smashed and stacked on top of one another. There was evidence he hadn't changed his sheets in 30 years. One dorm resident was a guitar major fresh from the Navy. We would play the occasional duet. He'd been drummed out of the service for smoking dope while cruising on a nuclear submarine loaded with Uncle Sam's finest missiles. I couldn't quite figure out how he thought he'd get away with that one. Truett Rogers lived down the hall from me in Kendall Hall, and when he married his sweetheart Melinda, they wanted me to play at their wedding. Melinda made me a fine cummerbund, but her mother objected to my white tie, which was made of cardboard covered with cloth from underwear, so I was unable to perform. That first semester, I met Paul, who was looking for a violin teacher. He was a double bass major, but had a hard time focusing on his task at hand, what with being a hippie and all. He would show up to lessons without his bow, or without his music, or without his bass, or not show up at all, until his teacher, Dr. Rainbow, said, "What you need is a good swift kick in the ass." I became his violin teacher for $2.50 an hour. If he was to be kicked, it wasn't going to be from me. I needed the money. We got along great. I turned him on to the Bhagavad Gita, and he bought a case of the Juan Mosquero translation to share with his friends. The dorms had an irritating way of closing during the holidays, so every Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter, I had to find a place to live. This meant finding food and figuring out how to cook as well. I had a copy of Francis Moore Lappe's Diet for a Small Planet that helped a great deal, and had a great interest in eating something besides the usual supermarket fare. Exploring for something good to eat, I found the recently formed Infinity Natural Food Co-op in a little storefront downtown. This was run by Terrence, 3 years my senior, a very striking figure with a long Hammurabi-style flaming red beard and cheerful eyes. Before becoming macrobiotic, Terrence got a letter every day from a friend in the Bay Area in California with a hit of acid under the stamp. But now he was completely away from psychedelics. Members helped out with chores in return for a price discount. Over the next couple of years, I became a regular and read a lot of the macrobiotic literature offered in the store. Little did I know how much those little books would hurt me. Christmas of 1974, I spent in East Texas. A fellow student named Patrick lived in Livingston, about an hour's drive north of Houston, and I spent a few holidays down there with him and his Irish-Cajun family. Pat was a cheerful sort who performed the blues. He told me Beethoven would have liked rock and roll, and I said, sure he would. He was deaf. One time in Livingston, the local radio station was changing formats and had a call-in show to help decide whether to become a rock and roll, gospel, easy listening, or country and western station. Naturally, I couldn't resist, and called in with my best prep school brogue, saying, you shouldn't be any of those. You should be a classical station, and you should specifically program Bach's B minor Mass and Brandenburg Concerti, Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, and Mozart's Requiem. The DJ responded, I don't think we have any of those. Which of our categories would you prefer? I said, well, it's sacred to me. So they put me down for gospel. On the way back, I visited Grandma in Rusk. Then 80 years old, she worked as an occupational therapist in the State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, which was a maximum security unit. I'd see a lot more of that in years to come. I brought my violin to play for the inmates. Grandma didn't want me to play my own music for fear that it would make their condition worse. So I played Bach. Someday, maybe I'll use that for publicity. Come listen to music that makes the criminally insane even crazier. By this time, I'd written several new pieces, and in the spring it was time to put on a recital. One piece was a newly rewritten version of the Children's Suite, this time for flute, violin, and piano, including the March of the First International Order of Scaly Creatures, a title I shamelessly stole from Jocko McNally, an Andover musician. Naturally, the theme went stepwise. I had to explain the dedication to Krishna, which was none too easy. I had rewritten the sonata for violin and piano and played it on this concert. In conclusion, was the much more ambitious Concert for Six, for violin, cello, oboe, bassoon, piano, and timpani. This time, I had another violinist perform, as I was quite attracted to her, and she played better than me. If I couldn't have a date, at least there were rehearsals. Except that by the concert, she thought I was a jerk. Oh well. This did allow me one of the only times I've had a chance to conduct. I learned the hard way to beware of wobbly bassoons. The timpani worked great, and someday I might include it again in a chamber work. This was not Eastman. Instead of tutorials with a composer who in a few years would win a Pulitzer Prize, I was in a composition class. At least the teacher said I had, quote, good note choice, unquote, whatever that means. He couldn't say the music itself was good, since it was not in a politically correct style. Musicians here would show up half an hour late and expect congratulations because they came at all. Students wrecked many practice rooms that required substantial and expensive repair. And not every music teacher was superb. My first violin teacher was an impressive performer, but a huge egomaniac. 3 years later, when I gave him a copy of a collection of my solo violin sonatas, he said, "When I retire, I will have time for trivial music, and I only play music that is engraved. I lasted 2 years with him before switching to Dr. Lurch, a very fine teacher. Summertime, and the living is easy. At the end of the spring semester, Paul and I loaded up his new little car and drove very leisurely to his home in Potomac, Maryland. We took the Blue Ridge Parkway along the crest of the Appalachians, where I played the Bach Chaconne to the trees. We'd decided to not smoke weed during our journey, but when we consulted the I Ching, the commentary said, "Two small bowls will do." So we complied. Paul's family was quite well-to-do, and his family home was impressive, with a pool, a maid, the works. Females picked up on his prosperity, and he was clearly the object of some competition by very desirable women, who found me invisible. Welcome to the world of finding a mate. No money, no honey. We spent 3 weeks in Maryland, visiting the eastern shore and bumming around in general. He had some hash oil, which I had not yet done. I gave it 2 puffs and found that it was absurdly strong. We got in his car, and I held on to the seat with what little of my sanity remained. It felt like the car had been replaced by my head, minus the jaw, and the road met the roof of my mouth with no suspension to ease the ride. Our destination was a friend's pool that was mostly empty of water, but had been completely inundated by tiny frogs. Our job was to fill buckets with the little squirming, jumping critters and dump them in the surrounding woods. I never smoked hash oil again. Paul and his brother were very impressed by Guru Maharaji Prem Rawat, who was then 18 years old. I had visited a grocery store in Denver during my summer with my sister that was run by his Divine Light Mission. The workers seemed spaced and robotic and worked long hours for very small wages, putting a strain on competing supermarkets. I was not impressed by the whole scene, especially as Maharaji claimed to be God, Krishna, whatever. The luxury of his lifestyle and platitudinous speechifying was hardly my cup of tea. The previous year, the perfect master had married an American against his mother's wishes. She decided that his brother, not Prem, was God, and put the brother in charge of the business back in India. Prem took all the religion out of his movement in 1980 and continues his speeches worldwide. But it seemed to do Paul some good, and so I didn't object. After all, I was doing some exotic things myself by way of spiritual path. Eventually, we headed to New York City for a night. We got lost at midnight, driving in Harlem, terrified that his new car would break down and we would be at the mercy of all these dangerous black people. Sounds silly, I know. All the streets are straight and clearly numbered. We got the hell out of there as soon as we could via a power U-turn skid on the main drag. Next stop, Boston. Then, a return to Manhattan, where I'd forgotten my violin. Then a bus back to Boston and on to Peabody. By the time I'd got there, I'd been on the road 6 weeks. I returned to a home in transition. Since I was out of the nest, my parents were divorcing. My mother now had no support and got menial jobs where she could, usually as a housekeeper. Sometimes she lived with friends for short periods. Grandma helped out and took her on trips overseas, once to Central America and another time to Egypt and Greece. Life was transient and difficult for her until she remarried in 1981. I stayed with Dad during these summers. He droned on and on with complaints about Mom, which I joined in at first since I had problems myself with her. But it kept going, hour after hour, for three summers. It was like reading a long book whose author keeps complaining about poverty, musicians not playing his music, and women refusing to sleep with him. That would be just unbearable. So finally I told him to please stifle the resentment, which he then put elsewhere. My brother John was living with his longtime partner Jackie Brodeur in Western Massachusetts. Eventually they got married. John was the only member of my family to have both stable employment and a good marriage. Kathy was enthused about the Course in Miracles, which is supposed to be channeled from Jesus to guide people into the New Age. I bought a set of the three books and went through them carefully. The course has become quite influential, and a lot of people have studied it. But there were many statements in the book that I knew couldn't be right. For example, there was no way I could accept that there were only two emotions, love and fear. That's not true even on a biochemical level. There was a kind of smugness to the course crowd in that if a person didn't like it or criticized the material, they were just not ready for it yet, and thus spiritually immature. I sent the books to Kathy so she could find them a good home. She said they would be there when I was ready for them. But I wanted to be the smugger, not the smuggie. My time would come. I visited Mom and played my first sonata for solo violin for her. She said she was amazed that I could play it, but I couldn't force people to like my music. Oh well.